where I both don't speak the language and have no way to actually go to legally. If I left, I would be more likely to go to Argentina because I was born there, or to Israel for legal reasons. But I'm not planning on leaving, and it was clearly a very big mistake to even entertain the question. What a disaster. On today's bonus show, we will talk about a massive winter storm coming that will stretch 2,000 miles. It is going to hit areas that don't typically have winter storms and are much less prepared and have disastrous infrastructure. Are we looking at another potential episode of what happened in Texas with electricity in a bunch of states because this storm is so widespread? And if so, what are Republicans going to say about infrastructure? Hope it doesn't happen. We'll talk about it on today's bonus show. We will also talk about the big headline among many on the right that for the first time ever, America's national debt has surpassed $30 trillion. What does it actually mean without hyperbole? We will talk about it. And lastly, their jury deliberations have started in the Roy Moore defamation case. You might have we talked about this case a long time ago. You might have forgotten about it. Jury deliberations have started, and we're going to talk about what's at stake there. All of those stories and more, I am told, on today's bonus show. We will be I'm told there's something going on for my birthday on today's bonus show. I don't know what it is. I'm as curious as you are. Join it. Join Pacman.com. Get instant access. And we will see you on the.
WRCT. Insane. From way out.
Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh. 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
For those of you concerned with your health and new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified. Bring you the best music.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
WRCT, insane, from way out.
Pose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
CT Pittsburgh, jazz is on one side.
Control Palestinians' daily lives.
Amnesty International, the world's largest human rights organization, has for the first time accused Israel of committing the crime of apartheid against Palestinians. The Biden administration's joined Israel in rejecting Amnesty's findings. We'll speak to the head of Amnesty International USA, then to the crisis in Ukraine as the U.S. sends more troops to Europe.
We are moving an additional force of about approximately 2,000 troops from the United States to Europe in the next few days. The 82nd Airborne Division is deploying components of an infantry brigade combat team and key enablers to Poland, and the 18th Airborne Corps is moving a joint task force capable headquarters to Germany.
We'll go to Moscow to get the response, plus we go to Kiev, Ukraine, to speak to Jan Egeland, head of the Norwegian Refugee Council. He's warning war could result in mass civilian casualties and displacement along the Ukraine-Russian border. He'll also talk about a massacre that took place in Congo this week. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Pentagon says it's deploying an additional 3,000 troops to Eastern Europe as the Biden administration continues to accuse Russia of planning to invade Ukraine. Pentagon spokesperson John Kirby says U.S. troops will deploy to Germany as well as Romania, Poland, which border Ukraine.
The current situation demands that we reinforce the deterrent and defensive posture on NATO's eastern flank. President Biden has been clear that the United States will respond to the growing threat to Europe's security and stability.
A Kremlin spokesperson accused the U.S. of igniting tensions on the European continent. Meanwhile, the White House says it will no longer describe a potential Russian invasion of Ukraine as imminent. We'll have more on the crisis over Ukraine later in the broadcast. The White House says a large-scale counterterrorism operation by U.S. forces in Syria has killed ISIS leader Abu Ibrahim al-Hashimi al-Qurashi. Witnesses said the two-hour assault by U.S. special forces and helicopter gunships on the village of Akme near the Turkish border left 13 people dead, including 6 children and 4 women, with body parts scattered near the site of the assault. This follows massive airstrikes carried out by Turkey in northern Iraq and Syria. Turkey's defense minister said the bombings targeted members of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, known as the PKK, as well as the Syrian Kurdish YPG militia, both of which Turkey claims are terrorist groups. One Turkish air raid that destroyed an electric power station in northern Syria also injured nearby civilians.
I was inside having dinner, then I headed out for tea. Then I heard the sound of a warplane and ran to tell my colleagues, and I don't know what happened next. All I remember is that I heard the sound of two explosions.
Kurdish forces said the U.S.-backed coalition opened an airspace corridor for Turkey to bomb northeastern Syria. Meanwhile, Iraqi security forces condemned the airstrikes as a violation of Iraqi airspace. The Pentagon says it's sending a guided missile destroyer and fighter jets to the United Arab Emirates as Houthi rebels in Yemen step up attacks. The UAE's military said it shot down three Houthi drones Wednesday, the fourth such attack in recent weeks. Meanwhile, Israel's military has joined massive U.S.-led naval war games in waters around the Arabian Peninsula. Naval ships from Oman and Saudi Arabia are also participating. It's the first joint military exercise involving both Israel and Saudi Arabia, two countries that have no formal diplomatic ties. At least 60 people were killed during an attack on a camp for displaced people in the Democratic Republic of Congo. At least 15 of the victims were children. Aid groups are calling on Congolese authorities to ensure the protection of civilians in the area amidst a spate of violent attacks by militant groups. The camp, called Plan Savo, is located in the eastern province of Ituri and is home to over 24,000 people, many of them families with children. The U.S. reported more than 3,600 COVID-19 deaths Wednesday, even as daily infections and hospitalizations continue to decline from January's record levels. In Washington, Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy says a panel of vaccine experts will carefully review Pfizer's application asking the FDA to authorize its vaccine for children as young as 6 months old.
Pfizer's application will now undergo the same independent, rigorous, and transparent review process that was used to authorize the vaccines that now more than 250 million Americans have received, including millions of children ages 5 and up.
As it awaits the FDA's response, Pfizer's extended its clinical trial to see if a third dose produces a stronger immune response in young children. Initial tests show two doses failed to mount a strong response in kids age 2 to 4. The U.S. Army says it will immediately begin discharging soldiers who refuse to comply with the Pentagon's vaccine mandate. More than 3,300 Army personnel have so far refused COVID shots. Meanwhile, a New York Times analysis shows the United States has a far higher per capita death rate from COVID than other wealthy nations, likely due to lower vaccination rates and disparities in U.S. health care. In Ecuador, the death toll from Monday's flooding and mudslide in the capital Quito has climbed to 24 people, with 6 people still missing. It was the heaviest rainfall in the area has seen in nearly 2 decades. In other news from Ecuador, a court has rejected plans to drill for oil in a protected area of the Yasuni National Park in the Amazon. It's a major victory for indigenous and land rights and comes just days after a pipeline burst and started spewing crude oil in the Ecuadorian Amazon. Back in the United States, President Biden's nomination of Jennifer Reardon as a federal judge has provoked backlash among progressives. As a lawyer for the firm Gibson & Dunn, Reardon represented Chevron in its lawsuit against environmental and human rights lawyer Steve Donziger. Donziger successfully sued Chevron on behalf of indigenous groups in the Ecuadorian Amazon whose land was contaminated by Chevron. President Biden and Senate Democrats have been moving fast to confirm judicial nominations, with 42 federal judges confirmed since Biden took office, the highest number in decades. Of these, over three-quarters were women and nearly three-quarters people of color. But Democrats in the evenly split Senate could see some confirmations stalled, as New Mexico Democratic Senator Ben Ray Lujan is expected to be out for at least 4 to 6 weeks after suffering a stroke last week. Biden vowed to nominate a Supreme Court justice to fill Stephen Breyer's seat by the end of the month. House Democrats have accused U.S. food and energy corporations of price gouging and pandemic profiteering that's contributed to the largest surge in inflation since the 1980s. Congressmember Frank Pallone said at a House Energy and Commerce Committee hearing Wednesday that corporate executives have unfairly raised prices not only on pandemic essentials like COVID tests, masks, and hand sanitizer, but also on staple items like food and fuel.
I do think that corporate greed is motivating large companies to use the pandemic and supply chain issues as an excuse to raise prices simply because they can. And a lot of executives brazenly boast to investors about raising prices on consumers without consequences. And these executives are saying they're going to continue to do so.
A journalist in Cancun, Mexico, narrowly escaped an assassination attempt Tuesday night after his attacker's gun malfunctioned. Netzahualcoyotl Cordera Garcerio, the director of the online news site CEJE Noticias, was confronted by a man in front of his home who pointed a gun at him and said, quote, "I am going to kill you like a dog." After the assailant's gun failed, Cordero Garcia and his neighbors wrestled the man off his bicycle and held him until the National Guard arrived to make an arrest. At least four journalists have been murdered this year alone in Mexico, making it one of the world's most dangerous countries for media workers. The FBI has admitted that it tested Pegasus spyware made by the Israeli company NSO Group that's been used by authoritarian governments to illegally hack the cell phones of dissidents and journalists. Pegasus uses a zero-click exploit to complete an almost undetectable takeover of a target's mobile device, granting unlimited access to messages, emails, phone calls, and location data while allowing control of the phone's microphone and camera. While the FBI confirmed it tested Pegasus spyware, the agency insisted it had not been used in support of any investigation. The FBI said Wednesday they're investigating at least six people of interest in relation to a series of bomb threats made against historically black colleges and universities and places of worship. All the individuals are minors, and the cases are being investigated as hate crimes. In Florida, a police chief described a phone call in which an unidentified person said bombs would explode and a gunman would attack Bethune-Cookman University in Daytona Beach. The caller claimed to be linked to the neo-Nazi group Adam Waffen Division. And in North Carolina, authorities asked more than 6,500 residents of Winston-Salem to remain away from their homes for a second straight night as fire crews battled a blaze at a fertilizer plant that threatened to ignite a massive explosion. Fire officials said the plant had about 600 tons of highly explosive ammonium nitrate fertilizer stored on site. That's nearly triple the amount that exploded at a West Texas plant in 2013, killing 15 people and damaging 200 homes, injuring thousands, and devastating Lebanon's capital city. This is Winston-Salem Fire Chief Trey Mayo.
Who has spent many decades in the fire service texted me earlier and said this is potentially the largest explosion in U.S. history.
Fire officials said the fertilizer plant did not have a sprinkler system or alarm in the building where the fire broke out. North Carolina building codes allowed the 80-year-old plant to operate without the safety systems in place because the plant was built before 1953, when sprinklers were first required. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, Amnesty International, the world's largest human rights organization, has for the first time accused Israel of committing the crime of apartheid against Palestinians. Stay with us. The story has not yet ended by El Fanoun, Palestinian popular dance troupe. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Amnesty International, the world's largest human rights organization, has for the first time accused Israel of committing the crime of apartheid against Palestinians. Amnesty becomes the third major human rights group to decry Israel's apartheid system over the past year, joining Human Rights Watch and the Israeli group B'Tselem. In its report, Amnesty says the roots of the apartheid system date back to Israel's founding in 1948. Amnesty unveiled their findings in occupied East Jerusalem on Tuesday. This is Amnesty's Secretary General, Agnès Callamard.
We are here today to call on the international community to take resolute action against the crime of humanity being perpetrated in order to maintain the system of apartheid.
The Biden administration has joined the Israeli government in rejecting Amnesty's findings. Israel called the report false and biased. The U.S. ambassador to Israel called the report absurd. In a moment, we'll be joined by Paul O'Brien, the executive director of Amnesty International USA. But first, we turn to an excerpt of a new video produced by Amnesty.
When you hear the word apartheid, what do you think of? Probably the disturbing images of racial segregation between whites and blacks in South Africa, where a regime ruled by a racist white minority declared themselves officially superior to the black majority, then proceeded to dominate them. South Africa's apartheid system officially ended in the mid-1990s, but that doesn't mean apartheid can't happen elsewhere. Here, in Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories, Palestinians are being forced off their land and out of their homes, separated and segregated by laws, walls, and checkpoints. They live in a constant state of fear and insecurity, and deliberately impoverished. While, on the other hand, Israeli authorities have given the Jewish Israeli population privilege over Palestinians in just about every facet of life. The question is, does this all amount to the crime of apartheid? First, the definition of apartheid. The crime against humanity of apartheid is perpetrated when particular serious human rights violations are committed with the purpose of establishing and maintaining a system of domination by one racial group over another and systematically oppressing them. But does this system exist in Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories?
And there's been a growing debate about whether the situation in Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories is apartheid. And now is the time for us, as the world's largest human rights organization, to offer up our analysis. Our findings and criticism are directed not at the Jewish people, but at the Israeli state. It's the Israeli state that put in place the policies that implement the laws and the practices that oppress Palestinians.
That was Amnesty International's Philip Luther. Amnesty video goes on to detail a history of the Israeli state, then document how Israel has implemented its apartheid system today.
One way to understand this segregation and oppression is to look at the ID system. Jewish Israelis have only one ID card, with a status that grants them the right to live almost anywhere they wish in the country. They can move freely with access to health care and vast resources. Palestinians, on the other hand, have four types of ID cards, if any at all. The kind of ID card you are given determines the level of rights you can enjoy and controls where you can go and what you can do. If you hold a green card, you are subject to military rule. And if you have a green card with a Gaza address, it means you're trapped in a 365 kilometer square open-air prison under Israeli military blockade in place since 2007. Israel controls what goes in and what goes out, from children's toys to medical supplies. 90% of the people have no access to safe drinking water, 47% are unemployed, 56% live in poverty. Palestinians with a Gaza ID are forbidden from going to Jerusalem in the West Bank, even if they have family there. Some people in the West Bank are considered to live there illegally and can be deported immediately to Gaza if found by the army, even if they have been in the West Bank for decades. Whereas, if you hold a green card which has a West Bank address, then you live here. This green card means you can live within specific enclaves surrounded by illegal Israeli settlements. And there's a separation wall and fences built around you since 2002, which Palestinians call the Apartheid Wall. It's 8 meters high in places and 700 kilometers long. That's twice the height of the Berlin Wall and more than four times its length. 80% of it is built inside the West Bank, occupying even more Palestinian land. There are separate roads for Israelis and Palestinians, hundreds of checkpoints scattered throughout, not to mention the 54 years of occupation, which has devastated the lives of millions of Palestinians. Palestinians with a West Bank ID can travel to Gaza or East Jerusalem, but only if they receive a permit from the military to do so. This blue ID is for Palestinians in East Jerusalem. They can travel to the occupied West Bank as well as to Israel, but they are not citizens of Israel. They have only been granted a residency status. This means that they cannot vote in Israeli national elections, and if they leave East Jerusalem for too long, for example, to study or work abroad or in other parts of the occupied West Bank, their residency is revoked, so they can't return. Since 1967, Israel has revoked the residency status of more than 14,600 Palestinians from East Jerusalem. If this complex ID system wasn't enough to segregate the Palestinian community, in 2002, Israel introduced a law that prohibits family unification. That's right, denying Palestinians the right to live with their loved ones if their ID cards are different. And this woman is one of thousands of Palestinians who Israel will not issue any ID card. She can't travel, can't hug her family, only see them meters away across the border. Putting down roots, the family home, these are crucial parts of what make a strong community. To make sure Palestinian communities can't develop any further, Israel has made it almost impossible to grant building permits for Palestinian homes. So, Palestinians live in a catch-22 situation. In order to have shelter or develop their communities, they must build without a permit. And if they do so, Israel can demolish the structures on the basis that it was built without a permit. Right now, there are over 150,000 Palestinians currently living under the constant threat of demolition and forced eviction, many of them for the second or third time. In the West Bank, an average of 18 Palestinian structures were demolished every week in 2020. The same year, Israel issued 1,094 building permits for Jewish applicants and only one for a Palestinian. This goes back to the heart of the issue. To maintain the state's character as Jewish, Israel systematically disadvantages Palestinians while privileging Jewish Israelis. This racist privilege has been enshrined in laws, policies, and practices, and it enables Palestinian resources to be taken in order to economically benefit Jewish Israeli citizens. Amnesty International and other rights organizations have been documenting patterns of human rights violations and international crimes for decades. These are the most visible and violent part of this system. At the end of May 2020, 4,236 Palestinians were held in Israeli prisons. 352, including two children, were held without charge or trial. Between September 2000 and February 2017, Israeli forces killed 4,868 Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territories, including 1,793 children, outside the context of armed conflict. And Amnesty International is not aware of any case in which an Israeli soldier has been convicted of willfully causing the death of a Palestinian in the occupied territories since 1987. This imbalance of rights, justice and accountability is never more clear than when a Jewish Israeli life appears to have more value than a Palestinian's. Israel's apartheid and its cruel and prolonged strategies deliberately disadvantage Palestinians wherever they live. They cannot claim and enjoy equality with Jewish Israelis.
That's an excerpt of a video produced by Amnesty International, released this week along with a major report accusing Israel of committing the crime of apartheid against Palestinians. The Biden administration's rejected Amnesty's findings. On Tuesday, State Department spokesperson Ned Price was questioned by Associated Press journalist Matthew Lee about Biden administration's criticism of the Amnesty report.
that it may be true that you don't offer public comprehensive evaluations of outside reports, but you certainly cite them quite a bit in your own human rights report. And I went back and looked, and, you know, in terms of just the last human rights report cited Amnesty International on Ethiopia, on Cuba, on China and Xinjiang, on Iran, on Burma, on Syria, on Cuba. And that those references are endorsements of what this group, Amnesty, and then other groups as well that are cited as well, have found. Why is it that without taking a stand or making a judgment about the findings of this particular report, why is it that all criticism of Israel from these groups is almost always rejected by the U.S. and yet accepted, welcomed, and endorsed when the criticism is of other countries, notably countries with which you have significant policy differences?
Matt, I would make a couple points. Number one, when we include a footnote in something like
these are footnotes, Ned. These are
when we cite, yeah. Which it's a game of semantics, I suppose. But whether you call it a citation or a footnote,
well, when it says in the report, Amnesty International found this X
yes.
in Xinjiang with right. the Uyghurs. And we determine that we think that it's a genocide, and you guys come out and cite that and say, well, we also agree that it's a
that
genocide.
That is a far cry, Matt, from saying that we have comprehensive agreement with a third-party report
So it's just when it's criticism of Israel that you feel free to disagree? Where have you ever disagreed with an Amnesty report or a human rights report on a country such as Iran?
This is not about any outside group. This is about our vehement disagreement with a certain finding in a report by an outside group.
That's State Department spokesperson Ned Price being questioned by the AP reporter Matthew Lee. We're joined now by Paul O'Brien, the executive director of Amnesty International USA, who's just returned from a trip to Israel and the occupied territories. If you could respond to the U.S. rejection of this report, along with the State of Israel, and also the significance of this multi-year project that Amnesty International has just released.
Thanks, Amy. Thanks for having me on. Thanks for your coverage. You're right. It's taken us 4 years. The report itself is 280 pages long, and because we are a human rights organization, not a political organization, it focuses on what is the international law now and what is the evidence on the ground through hundreds of interviews and looking in depth at laws, policies, and practices. Is this international legal standard met? This administration has already said, and these are their precise words, that Israelis and Palestinians should enjoy equal measures of freedom, security, prosperity, and democracy. In our view, as a human rights organization, the only way that Israelis and Palestinians can enjoy precisely what this administration has said is to dismantle the system of oppression and domination that currently exists now. You can't get there any other way. I think, frankly, that what this administration is responding to is the word and not the legal analysis and not the evidence on the ground.
Paul, explain why Amnesty came to the decision to call it apartheid now.
Well, firstly, why apartheid? People, I think it is a word that emerges from a particular socio-political history, as our video shows, but it also became in 1965 an international legal standard enshrined in the Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, which the United States signed, which Israel signed. It was then defined further in two other documents, the Apartheid Convention and the Rome Statute. It has particular elements. What we have done is to take a look at that international legal standard, that crime against humanity that is now enshrined in human rights, and compare the evidence that we found on the ground to that, that legal standard. And we found, with respect to every element, Is it a system of oppression and domination? Yes. Are there widespread crimes that are inhumane or inhuman? Yes. Does it lead to one racial group being oppressed and dominated by another? Yes. Is there an intent to maintain that system of domination and oppression? Yes. And so across all of these areas of rights violations, we found the crime of apartheid to be in place. Why now? It took us a long time to do the research. We build off the work of so many Palestinian organizations that have been asking for this legal analysis, frankly, for more than a decade. As you said, we build off the work of other human rights organizations. We wanted to get it done as soon as possible because the fragmentation, the expulsion, the dispossession of land and property, the deprivation of economic and social rights, it's ongoing and we need it to stop. And it won't stop without a serious conversation in these United States around what this country can do to put pressure on the Israeli government to dismantle this system of apartheid.
And Paul, how do you respond to those who say, even if it is the case that there is a system of apartheid in place in Israel vis-a-vis the Palestinians, that a similar argument could be made with respect to China's treatment of its Muslim minority, in particular in Xinjiang? And Amnesty has done a lot of work in China.
We've documented extensively structural deprivations of rights in Xinjiang, and we've done it elsewhere. We've applied the standard of apartheid elsewhere. In 2017, we applied it in Myanmar, because that's what we found was being experienced by the Rohingya people. It's an international legal standard. We haven't applied it everywhere that it could possibly be found. I hope that we will, but based on the calls of Palestinian activists that have been going on for decades, on the human rights work of other groups that have already documented it, there is a human rights conversation now going on around whether apartheid exists in Israel, in the occupied Palestinian territories, and we add our human rights voice to that discussion.
When you put out your report, you took a series of questions. One of them was, does Amnesty oppose Israel's military occupation of Palestine? Your response, Paul O'Brien.
We don't take a position on political issues, Amy. We don't take a position on the two-state solution, on the one-state solution. We are an organization that maintains our credibility by focusing on human rights standards and the evidence that supports them. Is it the case that the occupation that is ongoing has led to systemic human rights abuses? It is, absolutely. I was in Gaza on my last overseas work trip. I witnessed many of the things that you saw. I saw the restriction of movement. I saw the deprivation of economic and social rights and the failure to get even basic services. I've been in Hebron a number of times. I was in Ramallah last week. I see the checkpoints that we have to go through when we visit the West Bank. It is absolutely the case that the occupation is leading to systemic human rights violations. That's where our focus is.
Paul O'Brien, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of Amnesty International USA. We'll link to Amnesty's new report, Israel's Apartheid Against Palestinians, a Cruel System of Domination and a Crime Against Humanity, and to the full video that accompanies it. When we come back, we go to Moscow to look at the crisis in Ukraine. Stay with us.
Trouble.
Tired of Trouble by Lightnin' Hopkins. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. The Pentagon says it's deploying an additional 3,000 troops to Eastern Europe as the Biden administration continues to accuse Russia of planning to invade Ukraine. Russia's reportedly amassed more than 100,000 troops on the Ukraine border, but has not denied claims it plans to invade. Pentagon spokesperson John Kirby said U.S. troops would deploy to Germany as well as Romania and Poland, which border Ukraine.
The current situation demands that we reinforce the deterrent and defensive posture on NATO's eastern flank. President Biden has been clear that the United States will respond to the growing threat to Europe's security and stability.
On Tuesday, the Russian President Vladimir Putin spoke out about the situation for the first time publicly in a month. He accused the United States of stoking the crisis by ignoring its security concerns about NATO's expansion eastwards. We now go to Russia, where we're joined by Ilya Budratkis, a Moscow-based historian and political writer, the author of Dissidents Among Dissidents, Ideology, Politics, and the Left in Post-Soviet Russia. And Verso Books has just published the English translation of his book. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Ilya. If you can start off by responding to the increased tensions on the border with Ukraine, talk about whether you think Putin has decided to invade yet, and where this all comes from.
Thank you for having me here. So, first to say that, in fact, if you look back to how this escalation began a couple of months ago, we'll see that in the beginning there was just some kind of informational fake coming from the Western media, coming from US, about the Russian plans to invade Ukraine. And then somehow this fake was turned into reality, because Russia was answering to this fake and really put the troops on the border. So during these 2 months, we see how the escalation growing from the both sides, and we see how each side use each other to find the risks and to gain more from this very dangerous escalation.
Ilya, given the fact that the situation has escalated to this extent, do you think now Putin is going to invade Ukraine? I mean, Zelensky himself and other Ukrainian government officials, as well as, of course, Russian officials, have said that the threat of an invasion is highly exaggerated and is far from imminent. Your response?
So I think that if we are talking about the invasion to Ukraine as a kind of plan of Putin, this plan sounds really strange, because what kind of result of this military solution could be to change the regime in Ukraine, to provide some long-term military occupation of this country, which is actually a big country with more than 40 million population. Somehow this idea that Russia want to invade Ukraine replace the actual crisis, the actual problem in the east of Ukraine, where we see this dead end of so-called Minsk agreements, which are not really followed neither by Russia and by Ukraine, and which deals with the so-called People's Republics in the east of Ukraine. But as I said before, when this kind of fake, this kind of disinformation about the possible Russian invasion in Ukraine became a real subject of talks and real real subject of concerns, and there is, of course, growing military presence of Russian troops on Ukrainian border. This kind of invasion became more and more. More and more possible, not in terms of realization of some exact plan of military occupation of Ukraine, but as the possibility of the some kind of provocation or incident on the border between Russian and Ukrainian troops, which could lead to the further military escalation. That's why it is a really dangerous situation.
Ilya, could you comment on Russian demands with respect to the eastward expansion of NATO and also the relevance of NATO, even as almost a dozen Eastern European countries have joined the military alliance since the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War?
On one hand, you have these demands which were put forward by the Russia in the mid of December last year, where Russia concerned about the growing presence of NATO, the expansion of NATO, some possible plans to integrate Ukraine and Georgia into NATO and so on. But on the other side, you have the situation where during this escalation from the both sides, NATO somehow find its idea, find its legitimation, because NATO could exist only in the situation of the confrontation with the real enemy, with some kind of equal force. And of course, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, after the collapse of the Eastern Bloc, NATO definitely lost this meaning, lost this idea. Also the very kind of support of NATO, of the membership of NATO among the population of the countries, of the members of this military alliance, was the support was not so much. So the only reason why NATO now somehow get back this its idea, its legitimacy, it's only because Putin's Russia is ready to play this role of the enemy of some equal force, which actually Russia is not, if you compare it with NATO. Putin's like world view, it's very comfortable for the explanation why the NATO should expand
What's the response of the Russian people, number one, and also the effect of the threatened very high level sanctions against the inner circle of Putin, and this latest troop deployment, 3,000 troops now of the U.S. going to the border states?
Yeah, so we see that now there is the growing and continuing process of heightening the risks from the both sides, because you have this growing of U.S. presence, but also you have the new military trainings on the Ukrainian-Belarusian border, where Russian troops are also taking part. But if we look what happening in Russia itself, if there is support for this type of foreign policy, I will say that probably that is not so much. And even if we compare it with what happened in 2014 after the Crimea, after the beginning of Ukrainian crisis, when there was a rise of popularity of Vladimir Putin, there was a rise of anti-Ukrainian chauvinism, kind of imperialist emotions, nationalist emotions. For now, there is nothing like this. So during the last years, the Russian economy, the life level of Russians was declining. Also, the popularity of Vladimir Putin was going down. And for now, according to the polls, to the opinion polls, the fear of war is one of the main fears of Russians. So definitely, there is not so much support inside the country for this kind of politics, and that's why the main line inside the country, if you look to the official propaganda, became much more let's say moderate and peaceful as it was like 2 weeks ago, for example. So for now, the main message is no, we are not really planning any invasion. We will continue with talks with US and so on. So, and I think that is a kind of response to the real feelings of most of Russians.
Ilya, very quickly before we conclude, your book is called Dissidents Among Dissidents, Ideology, Politics, and the Left in Post-Soviet Russia. Could you give us a sense of how the major factions of the left in Russia are responding to the situation?
Mm-hmm. So, in fact, you can divide the Russian left in the two big fractions. So one is the, let's say, Communist Party, the biggest party of the opposition in which presented in the parliament, also some Stalinist groups who were the big supporters of the Kremlin foreign policy, who believe that this policy is justified somehow. But even if you look to the position of these groups by now, you can say that they're too much focus on this topics, because any kind of military unity of the society organized from the top immediately marginalized all the agenda focused on the social rights, labor rights, and so on, that are very much stressed by this type of the left. But also you have the, you can call the anti-imperialist left, democratic left in Russia, who was always critical to the what we believe the imperialist politics of Russia. So we believe that there is no just one imperialism in the world, not just American imperialism, but we are entering the era of clashes, of conflicts between the different imperialist interests, Chinese imperialism, Russian imperialism, and so on. So that's why for us the main demand in the framework of this growing escalation, the de-escalation from the both sides, the sharp criticism to the all the ideas how to divide the world, how to divide Eastern Europe, how to divide the post-Soviet space into some spheres of interests, and we stay for the self-determination, for the democratic rights, for the independent foreign policy for such small countries as the as the Ukraine, for example, not to be just subjects of these games between different global imperialist powers.
Ilya Budrakis, I want to thank you very much for being with us, historian and political writer, speaking to us from Moscow, Russia. And to clarify our lead, Vladimir Putin has denied claims that he plans to invade Ukraine. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We go now from Moscow, Russia to Kiev, Ukraine, to look at the situation in eastern Ukraine and the humanitarian crisis unfolding. There are some 2 million people face the threat of violence and displacement if the conflict escalates. For more, in Kiev, the capital of Ukraine, we go to speak with Jan Egeland, the Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. Jan, welcome back to Democracy Now! You were just in eastern Ukraine visiting the Donetsk and Luhansk regions and the contact line where tensions are high. Can you describe what you saw?
Well, I was there now for the last 72 hours, met with lots of completely exhausted, freezing, poor, miserable communities along the contact line. And they, their message, of course, to the world is, you know, enough of this political military chess game that everybody's obsessed with. We are suffering now. We've suffered for 8 years with conflict. Our communities have been divided in Donetsk and in Luhansk. There is a front line that has gone through families and communities now for 8 years. We need reconciliation. We need peace. Stop this escalation towards another catastrophe.
And Jan, as you've pointed out, it's not just the risk of increasing numbers of refugees and IDPs as a result of the present situation. There are already 1.6 million internally displaced Ukrainians who have been forced to flee their homes in the midst of this ongoing war in Donbas.
Indeed, there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people displaced. Some of them are working as my colleagues here in Ukraine. I have colleagues here who haven't seen their parents for years because all of the border crossings, not border crossings, these are crossings of the contact line, the front line, which is within Ukraine and through Luhansk and Donetsk. There are 7 crossing points. 6 of them are basically shut. There is one where there is still people being able to cross on foot. It's 90% down from what it was before the COVID, which became the excuse of especially the authorities in the non-government controlled area to keep people out. Now, this suffering has been ongoing for too long, really. We were able to make progress in recent years. The numbers come down in the people still being displaced. We operate with a figure of 850,000. We were planning to do further progress. Now, all of this risks to be erased in an instant. If there is war, there will be hundreds and hundreds of thousands or more people displaced. 2 million people live within 20 kilometers of the front line on either side.
Well, Jan, we spoke to you last about the situation in Afghanistan, and if you could give us an update on what the situation is there now, the UN just having made a humanitarian aid appeal that is record-breaking at $4.4 billion just to prevent a famine this year.
No, yeah, I mean, in Afghanistan, it's a race against the clock and against the freezing cold and against famine, really. for millions and millions. We are held back, not primarily anymore, by the Taliban authorities. We're held back by the previous sanctions regimes against the Taliban, which means that we do not still have functioning banks that can transfer our aid money to Afghanistan. We have to truck in life-saving equipment from Pakistan and Iran, and thereby buying nothing in the country because we have no money in the country, thereby ourselves contributing to the downward spiral in this economy. This was warned. I said it when I came back the end of September last year. The mothers, the widows told us we will freeze and we will starve to death this winter unless there is an economy coming back, some employment for our husbands and the day laborers, and a scale-up of aid, which is very difficult in the present context because of the financial squeeze and freeze on Afghanistan.
So you've called the sanctions devastating against Afghanistan. You just met with the Taliban leader in Oslo, and you spoke to the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations Friday, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, about both Afghanistan and Syria.
I did, and the week before that, I had a good meeting with the U.S. Treasury together with non-governmental organizations, Secretary Generals of the United States. So what we have is now a lot of declarations from the coming out of Washington that says that there is nothing precluding us to work in the country under sanctions. It's not criminal to transfer money there. It's all allowed. What I'm lacking is the proactiveness to say to banks, don't be risk averse. Start to operate again in Afghanistan. Help these humanitarian groups to get going. Help them to save lives. Set up shop there. Who will enable there to be a central bank of Afghanistan to operate again so they can issue banknotes? They can get the economy going back. It's not helping the Taliban. Who wants to help the Taliban? I mean, they took power with guns in their hands. We need to help the 40 million civilians that were left behind by NATO when NATO rushed for the door in August of last year.
Jan Egeland, I also want to ask you about another story that the Norwegian Refugee Council is weighing in on. At least 60 people killed during an attack on a camp for displaced people in the Democratic Republic of Congo. At least 15 of the victims were children. Aid groups are calling on the Congolese authorities to ensure the protection of civilians in the area amidst this spate of violent attacks by militant groups. Can you talk about what's happening there and what you're calling for?
Well, again, we woke up now just a couple of days back to the stories of the children that we provide education for being killed by armed men who attack the most vulnerable, women, children, the displaced. It's a camp in Ituri that has seen basically constant violence now for a generation. And it seems that we're not able to get protection of civilians functioning in the Congo. The protection is really an industry of seminars. It's not protection on the ground. These people, families, came to this camp because they fled from elsewhere. The one thing they were seeking was some peace and protection, and they didn't get anything but new violence. So the perpetrators for this must be found, and there must be an end to the impunity. And of course, the government of the Congo can do much more, and those who support the government can weigh in and do much more.
And Jan, in the last minute, if you could talk about the situation in Syria. You just testified at the Security Council, and now the latest news with Special Forces having killed the head of ISIS, U.S. Special Forces.
Well, what we comment on is the need for protection of the civilian population. There is a war against legitimate armed targets, which are, for example, ISIS fighters. What I am afraid of is a lot of drones and warfare from high grounds, from the air, that is hurting civilians. We'll find out more about this one. Was there even children killed? And if such, it is in violation of humanitarian law. It's as much in violation of humanitarian law if it's done by the US as if it's done by the Russian Air Force or the Syrian Air Force. We need to know more about this. Of course, terrorists in ISIS are legitimate targets.
And the latest news we have is that the U.S. has denied their special forces attack killed civilians. Witnesses are saying at least 6 children, 4 women with body scars, parts scattered near the site of the assault. Jan Egeland, we want to thank you for being with us. Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council joining us from Kiev in Ukraine. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for human resources manager. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Mary Conlin. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Brand, Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
This is Eric Harrison enjoying some whiskey before breakfast with Mando Richard. Wednesdays at 11 a.m. here at WRCT Pittsburgh. Drink up, Yinzers.
Episode 2204 of Whiskey Before Breakfast on WRCT Pittsburgh, WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark, Delaware, WUTC and WUTC HD1 Chattanooga, Tennessee, WKYWLP Kaiser, West Virginia, and Tube City Online Radio from McKees Court, Pennsylvania at WMCK.FM. I am Mando Richard, and even though I'm recovering from COVID-19, yes, your DJ got sick. I have got a wild show for you today. We'll start off on the liquored up set like we usually do, and we'll end up on the gospel side of the family like we usually do, and in between, we lots of good music. Let's get things underway quickly, shall we? Here comes the Nashville Bluegrass Band with the Gambling Barroom Blues, right here on Whiskey Before Breakfast.
Barroom on the corner beyond the square.
everybody's drinking liquor. The regular crowd was there. I stepped out on the sidewalk, began walking around. I looked everywhere for cheap, but my baby couldn't be found. I went by the big infirmary, heard my sweetheart mom. Jean urged me to see you. You know you used to be my own. Lying there dead. Strolled on back to the barroom, drinking whiskey tonight.